I'm Nina Cardona, filling in for Khalil Ekolona, and this is Nashville. Next month, Nashville Mayor Freddie O'Connell will set out his agenda for the next year in his State of Metro address, but once a month, you get a special chance to talk directly with the mayor about what's going on. And here it is again, Ask the Mayor. As always, we are very thankful that Mayor O'Connell is making the time to take your phone calls. And as Khalil likes to say, the mayor and his staff are humans, just like the rest of us. So whether you're calling to say, this policy's great, or you want to talk about something that's making you frustrated or angry, either way, the catchphrase around here is be good to each other. So let's keep that conversation respectful. And with that, let me say welcome to Mayor Freddie O'Connell. Thank you for coming again.
This is all totally unfamiliar. Khalil is not here. I don't know what's going on.
We'll try to make this a safe landing space even in Khalil's absence. This seems like a big week for you. You've got a big transit plan announcement on Friday, and last night council passed the East Bank redevelopment plan. So what's the mood in your office right now?
Well, we certainly... I love when we are able to get things done on behalf of Nashvillians. It's especially exciting when we know that we've got the Metro Council collaboratively involved and supporting that agenda. Just as we, a few months ago, passed our first capital spending plan with unanimous support from the Metro Council, last night our Chief Development Officer, Bob Mendez, was there with the Fallon Company, our development partner that emerged from a procurement process that was unfolding just as we took office, and did a lot of important work that I think is going to set up Nashville's next great neighborhoods for long-term success with deeply affordable housing over a 99-year period, lots of things in there for working families, including childcare, parks and green space, connectivity. So I think everybody's very excited about that. And then, you know, right next to it this week is, I mean, you highlighted two of the biggest items on our year one agenda. One was we knew we had an obligation under the terms of the Titans deal approved last year to make progress on the East Bank. I think Bob has represented our administration very well. I think council agreed. You saw that last night. And then, yes, this Friday we will announce the details of our transportation improvement program that we hope again will work with the council to get on a ballot in front of voters to see if they agree that this is the right path for Nashville this November.
So the phone line is 615-760-2000. That's 615-760-2000. We're going to jump to the phones in just a minute. But first, you know, I mentioned that State of the Metro is coming up soon, along with your budget proposal for the next fiscal year. And we're hearing that the revenue projections are flat. Before we open up the phone lines, what should people know about the city's financial situation right now?
Yeah, I guess the good overall news is that our financial position as a city has improved dramatically over the past term. So we knew we got into a position when I was reelected to the Metro Council in 2019 that we were in a place where we got an unwelcome, not unwelcome, but unexpected and sort of the kind of visit you don't want to get from the state comptroller, right? As the self-described money cop, you don't want them knocking on the door in sort of this uninvited way. And we basically were effectively told we had to have a corrective action plan for a shortfall in revenues. Well, since that time, we have established a fund balance policy that has meant that we have a rainy day fund that is now in a stable position. The credit agencies have appreciated the overall approach to fiscal responsibility we've taken. That has left us with the best credit rating in Metro's history. That is all good news. That's what allowed us to do a really successful capital spending plan just a few months ago. And yet, there are a couple of pressures out there on the horizon. The overall economic landscape has meant that after several years of, hey, we're putting these fiscal responsibility pieces in place in the middle of what is usually a four-year revenue cycle, it was easier to do that when growth was ahead of schedule. Like we saw multiple years over the past several years of surplus revenues into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And this year, we're not going to see that. And then that usually in Metro's history, we have four-year budget periods, and we are kind of in the fifth fiscal year. So we're stretching from the last moment of a property tax rate adjustment into a fifth fiscal year on the basis of that revenue. And so we're kind of we're catching all of those things also at a time when a lot of our one-time federal funding is, you know, it's reaching the end of cycle. So we've got multiple pressures applying at one time. And so without that, with that growth curve flattening out at the top, it's just going to mean this isn't going to feel like a big year of investment as we operate the government. So our goals are to be able to take care of Metro employees as well as we can, teachers, firefighters, first responders, police, the people that are just working in the civil service, and then to basically have continuity of operations on the overall Metro side. And so the budget will, you know, let us run things efficiently and effectively for a full fiscal year, but it's not going to feel like we've given departments guidance of, hey, this is not a year where we're looking for new programs, new initiatives. If you didn't get something off the ground as a pilot with CARES Act or American Rescue Plan Act, we're not going to be looking to add those things. But again, around the edges, we've got great capital, filling up maintenance projects, investing in schools, fire stations, heavy fleet. And then we've got East Bank getting underway now. And then hopefully by this fall, we'll have a great opportunity to have a significant multi-decade investment in transportation and service.
Well, there are these programs that were initially funded with the pandemic relief, and there's a lot of concern about some of those things. You know, how do you approach deciding if that can, those things can continue without those relief funds, as those are?
Most of it is timing issues. And so we've had some great success. Some of the things that we knew we had started as pilots, we are able to continue for at least one more fiscal year. So one thing we were very excited about that we've already gotten approved this year is another year of eviction legal counsel, right to counsel there, that Legal Aid is one of the lead agencies on. And then right alongside that, Immigration Legal Services. But we've had a lot of active conversation with Metro schools about some of the programmatic expansions they did, some things that probably would have fit better into a category of ongoing programs. I mean, and I know some of this is pilot and you see if it works, but things like universal school nurses, expansion of community achieves, we know these are things we want to sustain. And I think our ability to continue those things means that that's where we're putting anything extra, is making sure we get that covered, that we get a pay plan pulled together, and that we just generally continue operations.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones sure. now. Jana from Nashville has a question about some of the things the state is talking about with school safety. Jana, what's your question for the mayor?
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Jana.
I am wondering if the state does indeed pass the law that allows teachers to carry guns into schools, is there any way that Metro or Nashville can override that with either a public vote or our decision with our council to not implement that in our MNPS school district?
Yeah, Jana, that's a great question. You know, this is one of the challenges, I think, when you have state government with statewide elective representation that doesn't always match the values and policy preferences of cities, including the capital and economic engine of the state. And right now, that's where the balance of power is. It favors the state, where there is a Republican supermajority in both chambers. I know from talking to both Dr. Battle and Chief Drake about safety in schools that both of them strongly prefer to lean on a model of school resource officers. If there is to be anyone armed in our schools, it should not be teachers. We don't want to turn teachers into first responders in that regard. And I agree with both of their perspectives on that. Unfortunately, some of this will depend on the language of the bill. If it gives that permissiveness with no option for local intervention, no, there wouldn't be anything that the Metro Council could do. There wouldn't be any kind of executive order I could issue. So we're paying close attention to that bill in particular as it kind of gets finalized, and we'll see if it passes. We know, obviously, after the Covenant school shooting. This is not something that the majority of families in that school community, this is not what the, you know, larger coalitions that have emerged like Voices for a Safer Tennessee, this is not the approach that they requested of the General Assembly to improve school safety. So, you know, there is definitely a gap between not even just Nashville, but I think Middle Tennessee and across Tennessee, this is not what I think is broadly supported in our major urban school districts. And I know I stand with Chief Drake and Dr. Battle that we would prefer to see a different approach to school safety here. And we're going to continue fighting for that.
All right. I see that we have a caller calling from very far away. Khalil, would you go ahead with your question for the mayor?
Khalil from where? Khalil from California.
I'm in Koh Phanan, the island of Koh Phanan, Thailand.
Wow.
Yeah, it's midnight and the stars are gorgeous right now.
Stayed up late for this one, huh, Khalil?
Yes. I had to ask you a question. It's very
important. Can we ask you to turn down your radio, Khalil?
Okay, sorry. Okay, here we go. All right. Are you doing everything necessary to take care of yourself, make sure you're getting the proper rest, that you're eating well, that you're doing your exercises, so you can have the energy to take on the very tough job of leading our city?
I think most days of the week, Khalil, I hope that you'll be relieved to hear that, yes, I am. I've told multiple people that one of the tricks, because I get told a lot that somebody will walk up to me at almost everywhere I am and say, it feels like you're everywhere. And I think being present in the community and being accessible and available is a very important part of this, as we have been through so many things that are exercises and tests of public trust. And I want to make sure that people understand what we're working on and why and how we're getting things done. And so being present to share in that work with the community is really important to me. So one of the tricks has been what you're describing. I try to eat healthy, stay active, and get enough sleep. And those three simple things get me through most days in pretty good shape. And then I certainly do my level best to protect some time for our family to just get that family time.
Excellent. Absolutely excellent. Well, it's good to talk to you.
Great to hear from you. Yeah, safe travels. And if it's midnight there, don't forget to get some rest yourself.
Oh, yeah. So I'll definitely be doing that. Thank you, y'all.
All right. Thanks, Khalil. Good to hear from you.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Nina Cardona. This is Nashville. I'm sitting in for Khalil Ekolona, who just called in from his vacation for Ask the Mayor with Mayor Freddie O'Connell. Do you have any questions for the mayor? Call 615-760-2000 right now. And we're going to go back to the phone lines now. Claire from Sylvan Park has a question about pedestrian safety.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hi, Mayor O'Connell. I live in Sylvan Park. We don't have sidewalks.
Right.
Fortunately, our wides are a little wider, our roads are a little wider, but Charlotte is a nightmare to walk. And, you know, I keep reading about pedestrians being hit in Nolensville Road trying to cross. And I know that, you know, cars are heavier, SUVs, et cetera. And I'm just wondering if we can put things like those flashing light that you see around Vanderbilt for crosswalks. And maybe you could have a mayor's walking group that, you know, makes a point of going down some of these streets and thinking about, I don't know what kind of tax dollars are involved or if, you know, individual businesses and homes would have to pay for sidewalks, but I'm all for sidewalks, however we can get them.
Well, Claire, so am I, and great questions here and points, and I'll share with you, one of the things that helped us make a decision when we had the opportunity to become homeowners 17 years ago was finding a house in a neighborhood that had a pretty good sidewalk network. And we were lucky, especially back then, that was a fairly affordable neighborhood. I know Sylvan Park well, grew up basically around the corner, and know how frustrating it has been for several generations of Sylvan Park residents not to have sidewalks in what is a fairly urban neighborhood, actually. And so you highlight Charlotte. A couple things I'll say to this point. One, we know how important pedestrian safety is. We have taken a slow step back in the right direction after 2022, which sadly was the deadliest year on record for people just trying to cross the street in Nashville. It was our deadliest year for pedestrians. I am fundamentally committed to Vision Zero. Nashville is now a Vision Zero city. We have our Nashville Department of Transportation and Multimodal Infrastructure very committed to that. One of my final legislative acts when I was on the Metro Council just before getting elected mayor was to reestablish the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Commission. We will be trying to relaunch that next month for Bike Month, but we know how important the pedestrian initiatives are. That idea of walks is really a good one. We've done a couple things through the years. Mayor Dean had a great project. It was more focused on public health and public safety several years ago, but it was Walk 100 Miles with the mayor. But those two things are also very related. We know that people actually get out and are more active in areas where sidewalk networks do exist. Meanwhile, we have had really good success with Walk Bike Nashville and our Nashville Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, NDOT, what used to be Public Works, our Metro Planning Department. There have been a series of policy walks through the years, and I've been on several of them myself. I've been on one on Gallatin Pike at a dangerous segment of that roadway. I've been out on Nolensville Road, which you mentioned, and I'm very familiar with Charlotte. NDOT is putting tools into the mix right now that offer safer crossing opportunities, and they're also doing important interventions with the most dangerous intersections they've got. One of the most important things that has come out of our early Vision Zero work is they have identified a high injury network where we clearly need safety improvements. And so one of the things, again, that I did while I was on the Metro Council was fight for funding specifically for Nolensville. We turned that local funding into a big win for the city and that corridor in particular, with a great Safer Streets for All grant from our federal partners. Secretary Buttigieg and the Biden administration just awarded us almost $14 million to improve Nolensville. We are very actively pursuing every opportunity like that, and I'm very excited that the capital spending plan we just put together alongside some budget surplus funding from last year are going to leave us this year with the largest Vision Zero investment we've made yet as a city. But all of this talks to why it's so important this November for people to strongly consider our recommended transportation improvement program, because one of the key features of that program is its sidewalk investment. If we approve this program in November, we will have the opportunity, if we make even the minimal investments recommended under our strategic plan for sidewalks and bikeways, the funding over a 30-year period will let us actually complete our priority sidewalk network in the city. Now, that may not mean a sidewalk on every block of Sylvan Park, but it will mean much safer intersections along Charlotte. It will mean many more connected opportunities to get to Charlotte. And so we'll be highlighting that in the Transportation Improvement Program, with details announced this Friday at Southeast Community Center at 10:30 a.m. So stay tuned.
All right. Thank you so much, Claire. And when you call 615-760-2000 to talk to Mayor Freddie O'Connell, just a reminder, let the phone ring. We've got folks screening the calls, going to get you in the queue, but it might need to ring a few times as they're talking to somebody else to get things set up. And once you're in the queue, do stay in the queue so that you get a chance to ask your question. But we're going to go now to Lauren from Hermitage, who has some questions about downtown parking. Lauren, go ahead with your question.
Hi there. Thank you so much. Mr. Mayor, I wanted to know if there were any kind of talks or ideas or just conversations happening about downtown parking for residents. Obviously, downtown is one of, the biggest tourist, revenue opportunities, and parking is majorly a part of that, but it's getting more and more inaccessible for residents. So I was just wondering if there was anything that might be done about that.
Yeah, important question, Lauren, because we know as we work on the East Bank, for instance, where we're expecting to have residential neighborhoods in an environment that actually attracts locals. I know I've heard a lot of frustration from Nashvillians about some of the more recent characteristics of the entertainment district, but we know people want to come downtown to the symphony. We know people want to come down to see the Preds as they make the playoffs. We know people want to come down and experience our National Museum of African American Music, that there are so many things. We have the Mayor's Art Show up completely for free, available for anybody to come see at the Frist Art Museum right now. All of these things, there are so many opportunities for all ages and families, and we know we need need to keep downtown accessible. So a couple things there. One, I would highlight, we have several public garages around downtown, including the one at City Hall, one at the library, at the Convention Center, and up at the Fulton Complex a little bit south of downtown. All four of those tend to offer better rates than a lot of the private garages. When I was on the Metro Council, we did try to put some signage requirements in effect that would mean that at least if you came into a parking scenario, you would know what the rates were going to be. We're still looking at some enforcement there. I appreciate Mayor Cooper creating the mayor's office of nightlife too. Benton McDonough, who is the director of that office, works very closely with us and Councilmember Jacob Coopin, who represents District 19 and the urban core. We've worked on some initiatives that try to increase the availability of parking for musicians at a discount. But we've also looked, there is a historical precedent where parking and other things were available to Nashville and Davidson County residents. So it's very much on our radar to explore. Take a look, too, at Connect Downtown. NDOT, our Nashville Department of Transportation, has just put the finishing touches on their recommended plan for moving around downtown and how people access it both by driving and then also, you know, transit access and so forth. We know Connect Downtown is going to be a key lead-in to our overall transportation improvement program that we'll announce this Friday. But take a look at that. It's got some good ideas. We're following those closely to see what we can implement quickly to try to ease access to downtown. I recognize the concern from having represented the area for 8 years, so still very much on my mind and what we're trying to work on. So thanks for the call.
All right. Thank you so much, Lauren. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, we'll get back to the phone so you can pose your questions to Mayor Freddie O'Connell. Call 615-760-2000 to get through. That 615-760-2000. Stay with us. This is Nashville. Nina Cardona filling in for Khalil Ekelona, and this is Nashville. We are back with Mayor Freddie O'Connell. He's in the studio ready to answer your questions for Ask the Mayor. If you have a question or a comment for the mayor, call 615-760-2000. That's 615-760-2000. Or send us a tweet at This Is Nashville. Before we go back to the phones, I just have another question for you. You know, there's a whole lot of drama going around Metro Arts these days. If for those who haven't been following along, I would highly recommend going to our website, reading Chardaston's ongoing coverage. Long story short, there are a lot of questions about equity in the way the grants are handed out to arts and arts organizations, but also about financial management. It's become a whole thing involving the finance director and Metro Legal and the Human Relations Commission. And some places they're pointing fingers at each other, not just at Metro Arts. Meanwhile, the arts director's been on leave for weeks. What do you see as the way forward through all of this?
Yeah, there are a couple things. And I guess I would say I feel more optimistic now than maybe I did at the start of the year. And in part, it's because the thing I had been calling for within our office and, you know, in meetings with finance and legal as we sorted through this and knew that they're the commission itself. We were seeing a wave of resignations from commission members as I took office, and we got down to a very small number of members who were even eligible to serve as chair under the rules of the commission. So it was pretty unstable for a period of time. I think once we had come up with what I was calling for, which was let's come up with a solution to at least get money in the hands of artists and arts organizations as quickly as possible. Even that turned out to be a challenge because we encountered a system of multiple awards and kind of, you know, promises made to people that even setting aside, going back to the summer before I took office, where there were these controversial votes at the commission that set one funding formula up and then quickly followed that back up with another funding formula that some argued was maybe legally safer after recent action of the Supreme Court. Setting any of that discussion aside, it was kind of this question of, well, who has been told they're going to get payments and what amounts? And there are larger grants. There are these smaller Thrive grants that is a great program that has existed for several years now. I think it goes back about 10 years. And this important question of equity. And so fortunately, we had an opportunity to use some excess funds to effectively pay everybody under both funding formulas. And so the hard part, though, is with a skeleton crew on staff at the Arts Commission, with a commission where there is a varied amount of experience and, dispute that has spilled over into the Metro Human Relations Commission. We do have to administer this successfully to make sure that this gets out in the hands of artists in a way that we can represent. Yes, these are the people we said we'd pay, and yes, they got paid in these amounts. And so we have had to effectively involve legal and finance. But the good news right now is that arts, human relations, and legal are all talking about those next steps. HR is involved. We do expect that either there will, like, the director will return and the commission will make a decision about that, or we may wind up in a scenario where we have to name an interim director. And then I think the question then is, how would the commission prefer, and probably with consultation with the Metro Council, with human relations, to make sure we get these questions about equity answered effectively, how would they like to go through that leadership transition process as a group, and how can we do it in a way that builds trust and moves toward equity? The Metro Council just took a key step by expressly putting that sort of in the mission of the Arts Commission with a recent legislative act. And so we're continuing to talk to Councilmember Sepulveda, who chairs the Rules Committee and Council, about this. And again, arts and human relations and legal all continue to talk. Our office continues to be involved in these conversations. And it's a slow trust building process, because we know how hard last summer was. And we came into office with a lot of this stuff in play and in progress, with some things that were responding to controversy and very credible claims of lack of equity. And so we want to get to a place where what I don't want to have happen on the other side of all this is, we don't want smaller arts organization feeling like the symphony is the enemy, or the opera is the enemy. The city right. needs all of these arts organizations, large and small, and they ought to exist in an ecosystem where they support one another, and we're creating beautiful, challenging art in equitable ways. And that's our long-term goal.
All right. Well, let's get back to the phones now. Mitchell is calling from outside Nashville and has some thoughts about Nashville General. Mitchell, go ahead with your question.
Yeah. So this morning on my commute, I was, of course, listening to WPLN, and they were talking about how Nashville General's lease at Meharry is ending sometime in 2027. And everyone's looking at options. Will they stay at Meharry? Will they go somewhere else? And I was just coming, wanting your general thoughts and opinions on Nashville's safety net hospital.
Yeah, that's a great question. I know the SEIU just had a town hall with Nashville General. Our office has engaged with both leadership at Nashville General and also leadership at Meharry. They've had a long-standing affiliation where Meharry-trained physicians do a large portion of their training at Nashville General. I think there have been questions over particularly the past decade about some of the, the overall mix of where Nashville General's public finances are, what their census is in terms of patients they serve today, who they could potentially serve tomorrow. One of the things we saw play out pretty successfully overall was working with Judge Calloway and Juvenile Court Clerk Lionel Matthews as they looked for a new campus, what'll now be the Nashville Youth Center for Empowerment, NICE, is their new facility. And the mayor's office was involved in that with both of their offices over the past year and provided some support to look at the site selection process. And so that was a commitment I made to Dr. Webb at Nashville General. And we've had follow-up conversations with Meharry, and ideally, we will come up with something that looks beyond the end of that lease at Meharry, because I think right now it seems to me that both institutions would prefer an outcome that gives maybe a little more independence from the campus. I think Meharry would be happy to have that property back for their use as a medical college. And then I think Nashville General would love to have an overall campus or clinic model that is a little more independent. So we are committed to following through on that. We've talked to Quante Toombs, council member for District 2, who chairs the minority caucus. We know that's a priority for them. So we're trying to do this in a way that gives us enough time, enough lead time to get ahead of that lease, but also that gives us the best overall location and model for the hospital's long-term success.
Right. Thank you so much, Mitchell. And let's see if we can do a really quick one for our last about 2 minutes that we have with the mayor. I'd love to hear from Curtis in West Nashville what your question is for the mayor.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Very quickly, I'm concerned about pollution. I live in West Nashville near Charlotte, and the amount of noise pollution, some of it clearly intentional coming from vehicles, and some of it unintentional, I believe, but a lot of it is extremely intentional. And I'm talking about exhaust and cut pipes and whatnot, and also just physical pollution along the streets, the trash, the collection of trash. I'm wondering if there's some sort of way that this can be dealt with and if fines are ever levied against these people. I mean, there's a 90 decibel limit.
We've got about 1 minute left. Let's see, okay, Mayor Connell, what is your answer here?
Yeah, pollution in three different forms I heard there, kind of noise, air, and then litter. A couple quick responses there. Noise pollution is really tough to crack down on if you're not in a concentrated area. We have had some limited success in the urban areas. Out in West Nashville, it can be harder, especially, you know, we'll have people drive mufflerless down the interstate or do a lot of engine revving and all those kinds of things. We know that street racing has been a particular problem in multiple different parts of the city, and MMPD has stepped up their efforts there. Air pollution tends to be primarily a function of TDEC at the state level, but we do have our Metro Public Health Department involved in some of those initiatives, and Kendra Abkowitz, who's our Director of Sustainability and Resiliency, does a lot of work on how we ensure cleaner air at the local level. So we have a lot of things that are projects on her plate. And then finally on litter, the good news is we've put some money in the hands of our beautification commissioners, and the Nashville Department of Transportation continues to do that. We had our big spring clean event a couple weekends ago, and boy, did we pick up a lot of trash out there, but we'll continue to focus on all three of those.
Mayor O'Connell, thank you so much for giving us your time. Thank you so much, everybody, for calling in and asking your questions. Thank you.
Nina, great to be here. Thanks.
Great to have you. Well, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear about a special investigation by NPR that begins airing Friday as a 7-part series. We'll be right back. I'm Nina Cardona, and this is Nashville. Starting this Friday, April 19th, Nashville Public Radio will be running the 7-part series called Taking Cover during the noon to 1 hour. This is Nashville will return on Tuesday, April 30th. Hosted by NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman and Graham Smith of the Investigations Unit, Taking Cover investigates the worst marine-on-marine friendly fire incident in modern history and the events that followed. Here's a preview to the series.
On April 12, 2004, the Marines of Echo Company hunkered down at their combat outpost, an abandoned schoolhouse in Fallujah, Iraq. And then
I saw flames everywhere for a few seconds.
Big-ass shock waves, shrapnels ripping through everyone.
And then everything went black.
They were hit. Many were wounded. Some didn't make it home.
See the hole in the,
yeah,
the building? It's like a square. And when they launched that mortar, it hit. Boom. I mean, one out of a million shot.
A one in a million shot that wasn't luck, but a terrible mistake. I'm Tom Bowman.
And I'm Graham Smith. We're the hosts of Taking Cover, a new investigative podcast from NPR. It's been 2 decades since the U.S. invaded Iraq. At first, it seemed like a quick victory.
Remember, President Bush said, as of what, May of 03?
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended.
The war's over.
In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
So, okay, yay. So
mission accomplished.
Yeah.
3 years ago, a good source gave me a tip. A deadly friendly fire incident in Fallujah had been covered up for political reasons.
I mean, I'm not looking to be a part of a smear campaign, like meant to make the Marines look bad. If your goal is truth, I'm down for the truth to come out.
A formal investigation was buried so deeply the Marine Corps told us even they didn't have a copy.
We do not lie to our Marines. I mean, it's in our motto. It's in our motto, Semper Fidelis, always faithful. And faithful means we tell the truth no matter how much it hurts.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet. Why are they keeping it such? Why did they keep it a secret to begin with?
We've been piecing together how it happened. Why?
The fact that nobody has said anything, no paperwork, nothing, and I'm just now finding out there was even an investigation, that's kind of unsettling.
Our investigation took us across the U.S.
They said he died. I never knew his name. I can't find any document. Somebody took him out. That's a sin.
And back to Baghdad.
So why he didn't tell us? Why he lied to us? That's I want to know.
This is our effort to find out why these Marines still struggle to understand what happened to them on the worst day of their lives.
I think that was the first time I've ever had what they call a real flashback. I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust. I was there for a few seconds. Then a few seconds felt like a lifetime, but I was there. I was actually there.
Taking Cover, a new podcast from NPR.
This is Nashville producer Catherine Cecis recently sat down with the series hosts to learn more. Let's take a listen. Tom Bowman and Graham Smith, welcome to This is Nashville.
Good to be with you.
Nice to meet you, Catherine.
We are so looking forward to running the Taking Cover series, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, I'd love to get to know you both a bit more. Tom, you have spent a significant portion of your career, over 27 years, covering the Pentagon and the military for NPR and before that at the Baltimore Sun. You have reported on Congress, the NSA, national security, and have traveled to Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, where you were embedded with U.S. Marines and soldiers. I have a lot of questions about the military and military policies, and you are the person I would want to sit down with over coffee and just ask away. But I want to know, where did your interest in covering the military as a journalist originally come from?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I was at the Baltimore Sun, I covered Annapolis City Council. I covered the legislature in Annapolis. I also covered the Naval Academy and got interested in military issues. And then our Pentagon reporter went over to South Africa to be the correspondent there, and the job was open. I said, hey, I'd love to cover the Pentagon. I'm really interested in these military issues now. It was a great, great beat. And then I was at the Pentagon on 9/11. And then since then, it's really been off to the races. It's just been crazy with two wars and everything else going on. But it's been a fascinating area to cover.
I can only imagine. You know, I think a lot of people, when they think about reporters or journalists covering the military, kind of might feel like the military is pretty buttoned up and doesn't really want to share a lot. What would you say about your experience day to day covering what you do?
I think that is true. I think there's a reluctance to talk to reporters. You know, when I started, there was still the Vietnam hangover that you people lost the war for us, you journalists. But I think over time, once you get to know them, you know, you start talking about where you're from, what sports teams you like. And then, you know, you're out there in the field with them. You know, we would buy cigars and sit around with these guys at night around a fire in the middle of nowhere in Afghanistan or Iraq. And again, you create this bond. You get to know them a lot better and they get to know you. And it's all worked out quite well, I think, over the years.
And Catherine, if I could jump in for a second, this is Graham.
mean, one of the things that Tom and I talk about a lot is really this like military civilian divide, because, you know, as I'm sure you know, I mean, a lot of military families, guys who are serving in the military, their families always have. And there are a lot of people who really don't know anybody in the military. They never served. They don't know anybody who served. So just like you were saying, there can be these impressions about like what the military is like or what military people are like because of this kind of divide that that's going on in our country right now.
Yeah. Well, Graham, you are a senior producer on NPR's investigations team and winner of the 2021 Pulitzer Prize for audio reporting for the podcast series No Compromise, which is about an extreme faction within the gun rights movement. You have reported from conflict zones, have won more awards than I can share here, and have covered everything from the misinformation campaign behind plastic recycling, the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, harassment at a Navy base, and the Ebola epidemic in Sierra Leone. What is it about investigative journalism that keeps you coming back to work on story after story?
I think part of it is just what makes all of us interested in journalism anyhow, is just that I'm super nosy. You know, I wanna dig in and see what's going on, especially if it's something that's being held back or covered up. And that's some of the work that you get to do in the investigation side of things. I mean, I think so many, you know, journalists want to be able to do that kind of stuff where they can spend a lot of time developing a story, building a rapport with some of your sources so that you can really, you know, lay something out in a narrative sense that can really bring a person into the story. And I feel super lucky to be able to do that.
And a lot of it is a challenge too. If someone says, I'm not going to tell you that, as a reporter, I think your first attitude is, really? I'm going to find out exactly what's going on. I promise you, I will find out what's going on. I think that's what happened with our podcast taking cover. We got a lot of no's. We're still filing FOIAs with the Marine Corps, still trying to get information about what happened 20 years ago last week on April 12th.
The spark that started this series came from a tip that you got from a trusted source. I would imagine that you probably get tips or suggestions for different stories pretty frequently. I could be wrong. But what was it about this one that really made you say, hey, I want to look into it?
Well, first of all, I thought it was ludicrous. I didn't believe it. It all started where most good stories start, in a bar, at a whiskey bar in D.C. And I'd known this person for quite some time. And we were just kind of chatting about what's going on in the world. And he kind of just mentioned this in passing, that there was a friendly fire that was covered up back in 2004. And you know, no one has ever written about it. And my first reaction was, somebody must have done something on this back then. So I came back to NPR the next day and immediately went up to Graham, because we'd worked together on a number of stories, and I laid it out to him, and we're just like, this can't be right. You know, in our line of work, it's some things are too good to check because it's just so outlandish, but we decided to dig into it. Were there any friendly fire deaths on that date in Iraq? And then we just kind of went from there.
Wow. And that's where the series came from. As we heard in the preview, the Taking Cover series investigates the worst Marine-on-Marine friendly fire incident in history. But for those who aren't familiar with the term, what is friendly fire?
Well, friendly fire is when you accidentally kill your own troops. That's what friendly fire comes from. And it happens in war. And clearly, the military, in every case, they're supposed to tell the truth. They're supposed to tell the survivors exactly what happened, how their loved one died. And in this case, these families, these Marines, were treated shabbily by the Marine Corps.
There's a case we refer to where a guy kind of fell behind his unit and other Marines mistook him for an Iraqi soldier. Or, you know, there was a horrible friendly fire in another part of Iraq where, you know, a gunship strafed friendly troops. So, you know, people talk about it going all the way back to Roman days being mentioned in the Civil War. It's like an unfortunate thing that happens in the chaos of war sometimes. Question really is, how do you follow through on it, and what kind of accountability is there?
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard the term friendly fire. I was in high school, and I remember when it happened because I was reading about World War I, and I was so taken aback about how the words, which, you know, they literally say friendly, so it seems pleasant, but actually describe such a horrific reality. You talked about this a little bit before, but why is it so important that friendly fire incidents be investigated and reported accurately, both for families and for the military?
Well, it's also learning, too. You want to learn what went wrong and how do we prevent that from happening in the future. That's why it's vital for militaries to understand what went wrong here. And one of the things we learned as we're reporting on this podcast was that the Marines really didn't do anything with it. they told some of the families, or the family said, we hope you learned something from this, but they never put this into their training, as far as we could understand.
And Catherine, to your first question about the importance of telling the families, I have to say, sometimes you hear folks in the command structure who will say, like, you know, it's not as glorious. These people have already suffered one time. We don't want to make them suffer more by knowing that their son was killed unnecessarily, or their daughter. But I'll tell you, our experience has been 100% that when we talk to people, they want to know the truth. They want to know what happened exactly to their loved one. It's important to them. And this idea of somehow protecting them for their own good really smacks of people who aren't willing to step up and have hard conversations.
Does the Marine Corps have any protocols in place for informing families that their loved one who passed away could have been in a friendly fire incident prior to the results of an official investigation?
Very specific protocols, yeah. They are supposed to tell the family as soon as they have a suspicion it could have been friendly fire that that's the case and that they're having an investigation. And then as they go through the investigation, they're supposed to keep the family up to date. I mean, it's very, very clear in the regulations.
I want to switch to talking about how you approached reporting for this series. You approached many leads, and having listened, many of the people you spoke to were very willing to talk with you. There were a few, however, who weren't. In fact, your team had a very hard time tracking down at least one major figure. As journalists, if you have reached out to a source and haven't heard back, what guides you in your decision to keep reaching out and how you go about that?
Well, if it's a key person for your story, you have to do everything you can to reach out to that person. You send emails, you leave phone calls, you do everything you can. You do due diligence to reach everyone that you have to. And there's one incident in this series where people were trying to avoid us, and we basically tracked them down, in one case in a courthouse. It was a brief conversation, but we knew this person would be in court that day. We went up and talked with them.
The other thing I'd say is, I think there are different kinds of sources that we come across in a story like this, because some of the people who we really wanted to talk to were victims here, and they have dealt with a lot of trauma. And the last thing we want to do is re-traumatize them, you know? So it took a long time to start building bridges with these guys and talking with them sort of initially to tell them who we were and what we were trying to get at here. So that's sort of one set of people. A lot of guys who were wounded in this never wanted to talk with us, and that is their choice, and we would never push on that. But there are other people who need to be held accountable. And with those people, Tom and I were like a dog with a bone in our mouth. It was just, we're going to go after it. We're going to email. We're going to call. We're going to find out where you live, and we're going to come to the house and knock on the door.
And be respectful, of course.
But
we have to reach out to this person. You're not going to avoid us. We're going to do everything we can to get your side of the story and understand what happened.
And in part because we want to tell the story, and we don't want somebody to be able to say, like, oh, I never heard from them. They never reached out to me. We want to make sure we give them every opportunity to be able to tell their side of the story.
What do you hope listeners will take away as they listen through this series and then at the end?
I think an understanding of what these guys have gone through in war and how they look after each other. That's the best part of this whole effort we did, was realizing that these guys at the lowest levels that have been through hell still look after each other so many years later. I think that's what I really liked about this podcast, that they can be treated poorly and shabbily by their senior officers for whatever, for political reasons, or they're worried about this congressman, that congressman. But when it comes right down to it, when people hear this podcast, they're going to hear people 20 years later that are still looking after each other.
The other thing I'd say is that we talked earlier about this kind of disconnect. And I think, you know, this kind of a podcast, this kind of a story, which I have to say, we're incredibly lucky and incredibly grateful to public radio listeners for supporting this kind of work, because it's not cheap and it's not quick, really lets people connect with human beings in a way that you can't sometimes in a shorter format. And I think, you know, we talk to these guys about this specific story. As you go along, you start also to see the frame of this as not just this one incident and these one guys. I think in a lot of ways, it's about the last 20 years of war that the country has been going through. and what it is that we ask of these guys when we send them off into the field.
Beyond listeners, do you have any specific hopes that this series will be a catalyst for change in any of the military branches?
You know, you hope so. You hope that people will hear this, senior officers will hear it, and basically say we have to do the right thing. We have to lay everything out exactly what happened. We have to learn from it. But the most important thing is not lying to family members about how your son or daughter died in war. I just think that's almost inexcusable. But also, you know, you have to learn from this. How did this happen? How do we prevent this from happening again? And that, I think, is really, really important.
Tom and Graham, thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you so much.
Starting Friday, this is Nashville. We'll take a short break so we can air Taking Cover each day in this time slot. And we'll get back to conversations about Middle Tennessee on Tuesday, April 30th. Thanks for tuning in this hour. This is Nashville is a production of Nashville Public Radio. Today's episode was produced by Catherine Cicis and Mary Mancini. It was directed by Tasha A.F. Lemley. Our fearless and chill board operator is Liv Lombardi. The masterminds behind our theme music are LaRange and Namir Blade. Special thanks to Emily Dagger. Listen back at thisisnashville.org or wherever you get good podcasts. The conversation doesn't end here. Tweet us at thisisnashville. Find us on Instagram and tell us what you want from our show by filling out our quick survey online. You can also call and leave us a message at 615-760-2000. This is Nashville. I'm Nina Cardona. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.